We are getting geared up for the feast. Last second planning, there's a lot of things to get done. You know, a little stress gets associated because you're getting everything tied up and you're ready to go. You know, I remember 4 years ago when we went to Orange Beach for the first time, and yes, we are going again this year, and no, it's not technically our assigned site, but you might think so after all the years. But 4 years ago, the first time we walked into the Orange Beach Hall, it's like a convention center. Now, how many of you have been to Orange Beach, the site? A number of you have. Well, the hall, the convention center, is very well suited for us because that year we had around 1,400 people, if I remember right, which by today's standards is a big feast site, 1,400 people. This year, we're going to probably have over 1,000 again this year, if I understand right. So it's a big feast site. And I remember walking in the first night, and y'all can think about when you walk into the feast the first night. A lot of times you really feel a buzz in the air, an electricity. It's exciting to be there yet again for another feast, whether your group's big or small. I remember walking in with my two daughters and Colleen. We were there on time, but we were just getting there right not long before the services were started. Many of those 1,400 were there. And I remember as we walked in, the big blue eyes of my little Emmy and my little Ella just kind of stopping and looking back at us. It's like, wow, that's a lot of people. And I just saw their kind of electricity and their joy. And Colleen and I looked at each other and we said, we're not going to burst this bubble. We're not going to tell them, oh yeah, but you know, when we used to go to the feast, you know, we had over 10,000 people. This is nothing. No way. We weren't going to take that joy away, that electricity. You know, there's something about arriving at the Feast of Tabernacles. And so let's project ourselves now today to where we're going to be probably in just over a week and a half. And we're going to be showing up at the first night. And we're going to begin one of the most exciting times of the year for worship. Now, there's going to be a lot of great things at the feast. But project yourself to the worship that you're going to participate in and that you're going to contribute to at the feast. As you're doing your last second prep, is that first and foremost on your mind? Am I getting excited for the worship? Is my mind there? Am I anticipating? Am I prepping in my mind for the worship? I know that's what we all want to do. I challenge myself on that because I'm busy like all of you. But let's put our mind into that mode now today. Let's start gearing up for it. The title of my message is Worship for the Ages. Worship for the Ages. Where are you going to the Feast of Tabernacles? I know where many of you are going. Think about, though, the place, the location. You know, we don't need to turn there, but in Deuteronomy 16, we know the instruction that was given, and we read this often on the holy days when we take up an offering, where it says that three times per year, the Passover, the Feast of the Passover, the Feast of Weeks, or what we would know as Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles, what the Hebrews would know as Sukkot, three times a year in a place where the Lord would choose, the Torah said, show up ready. Show up ready. Now, part of that ready is to be ready to give an offering, right? That's a part of the worship. Now, when we think of worship, we showing up ready to the feast and think of worshiping God, what do we think of? Don't we think of everything in our attitude and our heart and our actions being around loving and fearing and obeying God at that feast? So that when we're in the building and we're taking in services, everything in our heart and mind is about honoring God and our attitude, loving Him, fearing Him, obeying Him. We're humbled. We're there to learn. We're there to become inspired. We're there to help inspire others as we fellowship. You know, when the Israelites were asked to come three times a year, eventually that became what was called the three pilgrimage festivals, where not only were they going to follow the command of the Torah and appear three times a year, but the Israelites, when they had a undivided kingdom, one kingdom, they would go to Jerusalem three times a year. And we talked about that. Mr. Black gave a sermon on the Psalms of Ascent that they'd read. And after Solomon built the first temple, they would go up to the temple three times a year and worship. Imagine what it was like to go to the temple for the feast, that place of worship. I look forward, maybe you do too, that at that time in the millennium, when we're changed, when you can kind of have the film played back, what did Solomon's temple really look like? What would have it been like to go there for the feast? I want to look at that today. I want to look at our worship, preparing, getting our mindset to have worship for the ages. And today we're going to take just a very brief, high-level glimpse at three temples. Very high level. We're not going to dig into a lot of details by any stretch. Two of the temples have already existed, and one's to come. And it's associated with the Feast of Tabernacles. And while we look at these, I want to look at four important aspects. Maybe you can say it's aspirational goals that I know you have, that I have, related to our personal worship and our fellowship at the Feast of Tabernacles this year. These are goals that I know you have, but let's put our minds around them today so that we get excited. What will the place be like that you're staying when you go to the feast? You often think first of, well, I got to get to my location, my temporary dwelling, my Sukkot, my hotel, my condominium. And is anyone going to stay in a tent this year? Mr. Witt? He's not? Okay. I didn't know if the Witts were staying in a tent. It's the first place we think of, right? I remember when I was a kid, we went to the Ozarks the first year for the feast. And then when I was, I believe, seven, our second year for the feast, we went to the Wisconsin Dells. Mr. Witt talked about some of those buildings. We called them the Tabernacle. And how many of you went to that Tabernacle in Wisconsin Dells? Yeah, a lot of you did, right? Nine times I went. You know, back then, if you were a local in the area and you were, you know, intent on serving, it wasn't commanded that you'd go. But you were kind of expected to go and serve. So my mom and dad, they were going to go serve at that local feast nine times in a row. My dad would always have us stay out in the far, far end of town. If you think of it in today's term, when you think of the wilderness, and then you think of the Kalahari, all these nice big places, back then they didn't exist. And if you kept going, you'd run into Del Rancho. Now, my dad could have afforded a much nicer place than Del Rancho. But he wanted to be out there because he wanted to be able to be on the edge of town so he could go out running. He was a big runner. So we'd stay there, but we didn't care about the place. I have such fond memories. I think back. It's almost like my first love for the feast, thinking back to those earliest memories of the Dells. We would take Mrs. Nina Kubik and with us every year, I believe, and then Eugene Kubik would be there with me. I remember one year, my parents got us these. They were like letter jackets, but they were Vikings jackets. Yellow sleeves. It had that cheap, fake plastic that was supposed to look like leather. And then the purple and the helmets. And we thought we looked so cool, those jackets. What will it be like where you're staying? What will the church hall be like where you're staying? I know what it's going to be like. We know. Those of us that have been to Orange Beach and are going this year, we know what it's like. Maybe you don't know what the hall's going to be like, but you have a little anticipation. More importantly than the place God has chosen for you to worship this year where you're going, what will be your attitude in your worship? Now, that's kind of a rhetorical question because all of us have the goal to have a really good, spirited worship, a godly worship. But it's good to start gearing our mind up now. Start to build some enthusiasm for our worship. Will it be exciting to walk into your feast congregation that first night? Will you feel the buzz? Will you feel the electricity? Will you bring the buzz? Will you bring the electricity? We feel some jitters? I still feel jitters when I walk in on the first night. Will you be excited to hear that opening night message? Will you be excited to hear the messages on the first day? Will you be anticipating them? Are you thinking about them already? What are they going to talk about? What are the themes that are going to come out this year at the feast? Will you feel a special anticipation every day throughout all the feast in the last great day for all of the messages? Will you be captivated by meeting new brothers and sisters, new friends for life, for eternity perhaps, right? Showing up every day at services and fellowshipping with them. Will this year be worship for the ages, for you and for me? Will it be your best feast ever in terms of your worship and my worship? That should be the goal. We all have it. Let's start to get our minds really into that. Now, I mentioned the temples. There were two. There's one for sure that's coming. The first temple we know was built because David, the king, said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar." David dwelt in a nice house, palace maybe, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains. So if people were to come up to Jerusalem on the pilgrimage, there was a tent for worship. David wanted to build a house, and God said, "Yes, I'll make a house out of you, David," referring to his role in setting and establishing his throne forever. Mr. Witt referenced that in his message on trumpets. But God said through the prophet, "David, you're not going to be the one who builds it. Solomon will." And so Solomon did. We read about that in the first part of 1 Kings. Solomon assigned 30,000 men to build that temple. 30,000 men plus others. When you read about the types of wood and the precious metals, the bronze pillars, and the way it was designed and built at the highest quality, you can imagine what it would have been like to show up for the Feast of Tabernacles. Someday, we will show up to a temple in Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll be there with hundreds of thousands, millions. So no one will ever be able to say, "I went to a feast with 10,000, 12,000 people. That'll be like nothing. We'll be there one day. But back then, imagine what it would be like coming from the northern part of Israel or the southern part, and to show up, maybe you were from the country, and to show up into Jerusalem to that temple. Solomon built this temple, and it became the center of religious worship in Israel. And it lasted about 400 years from its construction until it was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC, the first temple. How sad that must have been. Of course, they were going into captivity. By this point, it was the nation of Judah, because the northern 10 tribes had already gone into captivity. How exciting it must have been to go to worship every Feast of Tabernacles at Solomon's temple. It leads me to our first consideration, our first aspirational goal that we all have. I know we all have these for our feast worship. And that is to recapture that special feeling of the feast. Imagine how hard it was to go into captivity and then not be able to go worship. Imagine how much those captives and those slaves, we heard about that in the sermonette. Imagine how they sat in captivity and anticipated the time when they could go again. They thought, you remember when we used to go to Jerusalem and keep the feast at the temple? If only we'd done better, if only we'd obeyed, if only we'd appreciate it, maybe we'd still be doing it. And they looked forward to maybe someday God will deliver us and allow us to do that. How about us? Do we relive and recapture that special feeling every year at the feast? I'm assuming we've all had it. It's almost like when the Bible tells us to recapture our first love. Do we think back to our earliest times keeping the feast and all the feasts we've kept and what it feels like every year to go? Are we building that sort of anticipation? I think of all the feasts that I've gone to. You know, yes, I remember the Dells, 9 years. And those of us that used to go to those feasts, and there were probably, 12,000 people, something like that. And the parking lot was so huge, right? Around the tabernacle. So you didn't really want to get there late because you'd have a really long walk. And you remember when you go into the parking lot, there was an army of men directing traffic. And they all looked like Obi-Wan Kenobi. They all had their swords, you know. Remember the little orange things that would guide you. And they were always friendly until you got out of the line a little bit and they had you right back in. They had you trained. Now, there was one advantage, though. If you did have to park way out, if you were a little bit too late and you had to sit in traffic, literally, for those that never were there, you'd be in a traffic jam coming into the tabernacle. But there was one advantage. I bet you many of you remember it. You'd have to walk by in that long walk these little kiosks. And for the adults, they'd have coffee. Then remember, they'd have orange juice. What else would they have? Donuts. Donuts. Oh, that was good. So it wasn't all that bad to walk. I have very fond memories of those days. We could be let loose by our parents as kids in that tabernacle with 12,000 people. How many of you just were let free as kids to walk around? It was peaceful. It was secure. Maybe my parents were just irresponsible. I don't know. None of us were not free to just wander around because it was a place that was peaceful and safe. And then sometimes during the feast, we get an evangelist or someone coming in. Maybe even every once in a while, Mr. Armstrong would come in and they'd come in the back door behind the stage and it was so exciting. And the music, Mr. Peter Oakes led the greatest choir that I've ever heard at the feast. Think back to all the feasts you've had. I remember St. Petersburg in the big arena, probably 10 or 12,000 people there. Unfortunately, those were all my high school years, and most of my focus was on pretty girls and the beach, kind of like Mr. Witt was bringing up, the Beach Boys. Tucson. How many of you went to Tucson back in the day? Beautiful feast site. Many of you did. Got the chance to be in Guatemala when I lived there for a year. That was probably one of my best feasts ever just because of being with the people there. Those of you going this year, you will have never met people in God's church like those in Guatemala. I promise you that. They're special. And I'm not saying that just to butter up to Abby here. She knows what I'm talking about. So does Jason, the kids. That special feeling, the feasts in Jordan. The next round of feasts in Wisconsin Dells when we took our kids there and stayed with my parents, went to the Crystal Palace. Wasn't that what it was called? We could go on and on. Think back to all those special feasts. I don't know what's going on with my clock here. I'm just trying to time myself, that's all. You do appreciate that, don't you? I would think this group especially would give me a little kudos for that. The first aspirational goal that we have and we should start revving up, so to speak, is to really recapture that feeling. So that when we walk in on the first night, we feel it. We feel excited. We feel a buzz and an electricity spiritually. Now, going back to the temples, we'll shift back. We mentioned the first. Well, it was destroyed. We know that. In the second temple, the people did get a chance. Because some Jews were allowed to go back to Jerusalem. We heard about Jerusalem, streets of gold. We heard about God being there. There weren't streets of gold on this go-around, though, when they went back. God wasn't there yet at the temple. But boy, were they happy to be able to go back and rebuild the temple. 70 years after the captivity, around 515 BC, a small group of Jews went back. And they, of course, experienced opposition, and they got a little lax. They had to be corrected. They had to be cajoled because they were being hindered in their construction, but they pulled it off. It wasn't as glorious as the first temple, the second temple, but it was a temple. They were back. They could go every year to the temple and worship. That had to be exciting. It was referred to as Zerubbabel's temple. He was the governor of Judah. He was actually the grandson of Jeconiah, who had been cut out because he was so disobedient before the people went into captivity. But God had a very special place for Zerubbabel. He was a type of Christ. And that temple, along with some renovations by King Herod, stood for 600 years. It wasn't as glorious as the first temple, but it stood for 600 years until 70 AD. And then it was sacked, the city was sacked and burned by the Romans. And the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. There's never been a temple there since. You can go there today. Many of you have. You can see people go up to the outer wall, what they call the Western Wall. Dusty and Jana were there this spring. Many of you have been there. You can see people worshiping, but there's no temple. There's no going up there every year for the feast. Though Israel has control of that area, Israel's a nation of Jewish people, there's no temple. In fact, when you go up on the Temple Mount, any of us that have been there will tell you, it's inspiring on the one hand, but it's a little tense, a little different on the other hand. There's a very famous monument, the Dome of the Rock, a Muslim monument there. When you go up there, there's no Jews. At least if they're Jewish, they're not letting you know that. There are a lot of Arabs because it's under control, that site, by my beloved Jordan. That's who controls it. Jews are not allowed on that site. They can't worship there. They can't sacrifice there. That's by edict of the Israeli government and by edict of the chief rabbinate. They don't want religious Jews walking around up there desecrating it. So a couple times a year, they're allowed up there strictly for tourist reasons. No worshiping, no prayers, no temple, no sacrifices. In a way, though it's kind of inspiring, it's kind of depressing when you go there. It's kind of depressing, unless you picture it in the future. Unless you stand there and you think, what will this be someday? This brings me to the second consideration or aspirational goal for our feast worship. It's one we all share. But let's start thinking about this. And that is that when we're at the feast, that we would see, experience, and promote the presence of God the Father and Jesus Christ in all aspects of our feast worship. That we'd see, maybe not physically that we'd see God, because we know that doesn't happen, but we'd see his presence. Maybe see it through what we hear. The words of God being expounded. I guess that's hearing, not seeing. But we'd envision now by what we hear, we'd start to see in our mind's eye. And that would enhance our worship. We'd experience the presence of God the Father and Jesus Christ by virtue of not only what we hear, but what we experience in the worship. The people, the fellowship, the attitudes. what you experience, that we would bring something special to the party. That's promoting the presence of God the Father and Jesus Christ in our worship. In the services, the music, the fellowship, the organized activities, the meals we have with one another. Always we think about the meals at the feast, special time. That a spirit is created. You see, in Jerusalem now, they don't even go there for the Feast of Tabernacles. Some religious Jews will go to the Western Wall, but no one's going there to worship at the temple. God's not there. In their world, God's not there. They're going to have a temple for his presence to come back. And believe you me, religious Jews intend that that happens because they want God's presence back there. We're so blessed, though, on the other hand, to know that we show up at the feast and God is present. He's chosen the place. We're there. We get to participate. That should be so humbling and yet exciting to us. I remember 5 years ago when we went to St. Augustine for the feast. And I walked in and there was a tall gentleman in front of me. And right as I was getting near him or on the side, we kind of turned and saw each other. And he was an old friend. Went to Ambassador College with him. His name was Tim Dickey. Is Tim Dickey. He's been at Orange Beach all the successive years. Always excited to see him. Sarah, you probably knew Tim. I don't know. I went to college with him in Big Sandy. Only 1 year, so we were only so close, but I had fond memories. We played a lot of basketball together. He was 6'4". I was pushing near 6 foot at that time. I've shrunken a lot since then. But he could dunk. So in a way, I liked him a lot. He was a good guy, but I kind of didn't like him. Because I don't know that I could touch the rim back then. Oh, we were happy to see each other. Because you don't always know who's still in the church. And you show up. That was the first night. And it was so exciting that here Tim and his wife Lisa were there at the feast. And so we spent some time together at the feast. Now, he had been coming out of a rough church experience the prior couple of years. And towards the end of the feast, we were having lunch, and he said, "You know, Corey," he said, "I can't tell you what this feast has meant to me." He said, "The people here," he said, "the spirit," so just the spirit of the people. Now, he'd had a couple of rough feasts prior. He was so thankful at the spirit and attitude of the people. He felt the presence of God, the Father, and Jesus Christ through the people, through the Holy Spirit, through the attitude, the fellowship, the words, the conversations, the smiles. He felt it. Now, all of you want to bring that. We all have that goal. Is that top of mind as we prepare, as we go through this last minute dash to the feast? Is that top of mind? See, experience, and promote the presence of God the Father and Jesus Christ in all aspects of our feast worship. Now, let's jump back into the temples. We said there were two. We all knew that. We reviewed the fact that people would go there to worship 3 times a year in Jerusalem, the feasts of the pilgrimage. But how about a third temple? We all understand that concept. We're aware of it, but it hasn't come yet. Like we said, there hasn't been a temple in Jerusalem since 70 AD. And that was the second temple that got leveled. Now, there are 3 scriptural indications of what possibly that temple could be. We're going to settle on one here. 2 represent a literal temple and 1 a symbolic temple. We can dismiss the symbolic one, which really is an allegorical one, which basically says that the third temple is represented in the church. It's represented in you and me. We've already even talked about it. It's represented in people called with God's Spirit. They have God in them, and they're called a temple. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 3, we will read the scriptures, but before we do that, let's just go ahead and dismiss this. This is from the Expositor's Bible Commentary. This is what it says about that as a possibility, a figurative or an allegorical. It says, the figurative or spiritualizing interpretive approach for the third temple does not seem to solve any of the problems of Ezekiel 40 to 48. We're going to go there. It tends to create new ones. To interpret these chapters in any manner other than a normal literal approach, that referring to Ezekiel 40 to 48, would appear to contradict the interpretive guide in the vision, who warns Ezekiel that he is to write down all the minute details concerning the plan for the temple and its regulations so that these details might be considered carefully and followed in every aspect. You see, there is a temple. We'll go there. We're not going to get into the detail, but it describes in detail a new temple in Jerusalem. But the spiritual allegory just doesn't fit at the end. Now, it doesn't mean, though, that 1 Corinthians 3 doesn't matter. We've kind of alluded to this ourselves already. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 16 says, do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? How much of the worship at your feast, where God will have placed his name, at my feast, will be impacted by this? It's central. It's core. Because every feast is made up of these individuals that come together and families that come. And they're temples, temples for the Spirit. So though it doesn't define or satisfy the third temple, it satisfies an important part of true worship. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 2. This is a well-known scripture, but some think this could be the representation of the third temple. It's the church, some say. Verse 21, jumping in to the thought, it says, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Yes, the church is a spiritual temple. And we go to the feast and we represent that spiritual temple when we're there. But it's important for us, even if that's not representing a literal temple, to consider this. And it brings me to the third out of the four considerations for our feast worship, our aspirational goals. And it ties into the second one that we just had, which is that we have the opportunity to bring a fundamental joy and energy to the services, to the fellowship, and to all the activities. All that goes on at the feast, even in our temporary dwellings with our families. We have the opportunity, we could even say God would expect for us to bring a fundamental joy and energy to services, fellowship, and all activities every day. To bring a fundamental joy and an energy to the new people we meet, where we lift them up. Imagine if at your feast site or our feast site, imagine if every day when everyone arrives at the services, if every person in that building has prayed to God before coming and just begged him to pour his Holy Spirit in them. Now, many, many will have, but imagine if everyone walking, entering that place of worship is powerfully filled with the Holy Spirit. It will be worship for the ages. You will have your best feast ever. We always talk about that, right? Taking the time to pray and study. I'm fortunate because when we go to Orange Beach together, I've inherited something my dad has suffered from for a very long time in his life. I wake up normally well before sunrise with no alarm. Now, my dad's done that, I think, his whole life. I think he did that even when he was a swaddling baby. That's my guess. Is that true, Dad? I just thought he was nuts when I grew up. How does someone get up so early? Well, now, here we are, dragging ourselves out in the morning. It's dark. One of us will be up first getting the coffee going. But what's wonderful about it is this, is my mom will eventually join us not long before the sun comes up, and there we are sitting on our balcony as the sun rises over the ocean. And my dad will pull out either his Kindle or his Bible, and we will read scripture in the morning. And we will, most mornings, if not all, pray together on that balcony. I give the credit to my mother and father for that. So we have the opportunity to bring a spiritual mindset, to be filled with the Holy Spirit, to raise the level of the worship at the feast. Now, kind of a last little bit here on the third temple before we wrap up and get our fourth consideration. But there is indications that there is going to be a literal temple. Now, I said there were two. One is that people believe there may be a temple before the end of this age on the holy site in Jerusalem. We know from Daniel 8 that sacrifices at the end will be set up in Jerusalem on the location of where the temple would be, daily sacrifices. There's a reference to the little horn who was known as Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a type of a false end-time religious power that joins up with a civil power called the beast. Daniel himself was inspired to prophesy in Daniel 12 of daily sacrifice occurring when giving his end-time prophecy. And Jesus even himself in Matthew 24:15, what did he talk about? In the end, he talked about the abomination of desolation occurring. There will be sacrifices on the Temple Mount, that area, in the end. It doesn't necessarily require a temple. There could be a temple. We've all heard the stories. Some of you have probably studied into the fact that there are organizations of religious people all ready to go, set the temple up. They got all the instruments, everything they need. Turn it on and we can go. But it's not required. Prior to the second temple built, they sacrificed strictly on an altar in the holy place before the temple was built. An altar could be erected, so we don't know if a temple will be built. If one is, it's very possible that it will be destroyed, either through the war that will occur in Jerusalem, or because we know that when Christ returns and his feet touch the Mount of Olives, we know, according to Zechariah 14, a plain will be enacted. There will be a plain, probably 60 to 70 square miles, and it will go right over where the Temple Mount is today, where a temple would be built. We also know in Zechariah 14, it says out of Jerusalem, rivers will flow to the Eastern Sea and to the Western Sea, to the Dead Sea, in the Mediterranean. The place will start to grow in a way that it hasn't. Even with all of Israel's reforestation, it's still an arid, dry land. But there is a very detailed explanation in Ezekiel 40 through 48. You can turn to Ezekiel 43. We're not going to read much. Time does not permit that today. It's a study in itself. I know in my Bible, the particular one now, it has a detailed layout of the design of this temple. But in Ezekiel 40 to 48, we can summarize it this way. A new city and a new temple will be built. Again, a new plain will be there. It describes in detail the dimensions of all the various parts of the temple. And by the way, they're different than the previous temples. They're different. It describes a system of sacrifices. Yes. When a temple is set up, in the future. And by the way, this is a time that the context of the prophecy is the millennium. You see, we call this temple the millennial temple. We're aware of this. And it's interesting because people, Israelites, non-Israelites, will be like you and me. They will be under the new covenant, those people that are there. But yet there will be sacrifices. Some see that as a contradiction. But perhaps it's God's way of saying, it's Jesus Christ's way of saying, you see, from the beginning to now, it all fits. It all fits together. It talks about a time when a beautiful building will be erected and people will be expected to come from all the nations, perhaps representatives of the families will be coming up. There will be a physical priesthood there to administer to needs. Needs not only related to the temple, but I'm assuming even helping people that are attending the feasts. There will be a spiritual priesthood, you and I. Those that have come before us that are resurrected, or if we're resurrected at that time. Zechariah 14 describes that when Jesus Christ comes back, there will be the saints with him. We will be there at this temple. We often call it Ezekiel's temple or the millennial temple. And the historical fulfillment says that this temple will occur. There's great detail and time given to the description of this, as I mentioned. And then in Ezekiel 47, he even describes how the water started to come up out of the temple, first to his ankles, then up his legs, to his waist. And it suddenly got to be such a big river coming out of that temple, going to the east and west, that you couldn't even get across it. Exactly what we read about in Zechariah 14. Imagine the beauty of that city, of that temple. Now we arrive at what we hear about in the special music. Streets of gold. People will go to the Feast of Tabernacles, to the feasts, to Jerusalem, and they'll worship in a beautiful place. And the most interesting and exciting thing at all, we find in Ezekiel 43. But before going there, I want you to think, as we begin to wrap this message up, and yes, I meant that, Jonathan, we are heading that direction. Think of the most beautiful place you ever worshipped. Just imagine it right now, while you've been in the Church of God. I really appreciate this hall. Not so much today. I'm sweating like the proverbial pig. Or wait a minute, pigs don't sweat. Well, I just look like a pig sweating. The most beautiful place I've ever been for worship was the Ambassador Auditorium. In fact, some say that it was designed similarly to the temple. Beautiful marble, carpets imported from India, acoustical panels. It had, supposedly, you can ask Mr. David Witt, he managed the concert series in there for many, many years. Met a lot of famous musicians. So he'll thank me for that because now you'll all be wanting to talk to him about that. But the acoustical panels with gold leaf covering them, the sound. I remember walking in because as students at Ambassador College, we were assigned to the auditorium PM congregation. We got to go there every week for services. And it was beautiful, even down to the smell of the place. They managed the smell. At least I think they did, because I never remember it smelling bad. It always smelled good. But what was so exciting about it wasn't just the place. There were times when we'd hear Mr. Armstrong, you'd see him stroll up on stage. I got to see his last messages. I was very fortunate, very blessed. Or they'd cart out some evangelist. They didn't speak all that often, so when you got a sermon from them, it was the best sermons. They'd inspire you and motivate you. It was quite a place to go worship. But it's not ours anymore. You know, it had over 2,500 concerts there. Pavarotti, Placido Domingo, Yo-Yo Ma, Bing Crosby, Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, the Vienna Philharmonic, the Berlin Philharmonic. And whenever someone would walk into that hall, they'd see these marble walls, this great auditorium, and it would say, dedicated to the honor and glory of the great God. That was what we wanted to represent ourselves to the world. Those words are gone. I had to have David Witt. I forgot to grab those, and thankfully he texted a shot of that wall to me on my way up to St. Cloud. But he told me those words are gone now. It just says Ambassador Auditorium. That place, as beautiful, inspiring as it was, does not begin to compare with what we are going to witness in Jerusalem. It doesn't compare. Streets of gold. That song we heard in Special Music talked about God being there. God being there in Israel. Let's go to Ezekiel 43. I think I have you there already. It's the last we'll read today out of any scriptures. It says in verse 1, this is Ezekiel describing his vision of this temple. He says, afterward, he brought me to the gate that faces toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. His voice was like the sound of many waters. You see, there will be millions of people there worshiping at the feast. It will be set up to handle millions, but it'll have to go out from the temple. But it won't matter because Jesus Christ will be leading the worship. And his voice is going to be like what we hear here, the sound of many waters. He doesn't need any speakers. It says, and the earth shone with his glory. Imagine when the physical people come up to worship for the Feast of Tabernacles. Imagine their worship experience to hear Christ's voice and to feel his glory shining. They'll all be able to see him. He'll be able to manifest himself as far as he wants to. But it will be glorious. And we'll be there as spiritual priests with him, ministering and serving the people. That's what's going to be in that temple. It says in verse 3, it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when I came to destroy the city. Verse 4, and the glory of the Lord came into the temple by the way of the gates which faces toward the east. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. That is what we have to look forward to. We're going to be there. So it brings me to my final fourth consideration for our feast worship. And that is that while we're at the feast worshiping, trying to have worship for the ages, let's not lose sight and let's envision all of mankind left on the earth worshiping at the millennial temple in the future, or certainly at least representatives from all of mankind on the earth and the families on earth. In Zechariah 14, at the end, it describes that every nation will be expected to have its people go to the feast in Jerusalem. Every nation. Jesus and Christ himself will lead the worship. So when we think of the future, the millennium, let's envision that time. When we sit in services and we hear great messages, let's envision a time when all of mankind and us right there with Jesus Christ get to see him, to experience him real time, leading the worship. You know, in conclusion, we don't have to wait for the millennium to worship at the Feast of Tabernacles. We don't have to wait until we're changed to worship at the Feast of Tabernacles. We don't have to wait till the temple is built. That's described in Ezekiel 40 to 48. However, we look very, very forward to that because it's for all mankind now. It's special not just for us, but for all mankind. We are so blessed to keep the feast today, the Feast of Tabernacles, this year, 2017. We are the most blessed people on earth to go and keep God's feast and to fear Him and to worship before Him. There is no more blessed people than we. God has given us the opportunity to bring very, very much to our worship to the feast. A lot of it's in our hands. A lot of it's about the energy we pour into it. A lot of it's about how we engage God. A lot of it's about how we engage the Holy Spirit. A lot of it's just about the attitude with which we show up every day to services, every opportunity to fellowship, every event, every activity, every meal. God gives us a tremendous opportunity. Make this Feast of Tabernacles a worship for the ages.